All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Monday, November 20th, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup of Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Monday, everyone. It is a chilly 33 degrees with snow on the ground here in upstate New York. So where did we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Ben Gortzel, Artificial General Intelligence and the Singularity. We listened to three different, I don't know if you'd call them talks, they weren't interviews. He was giving a discussion by Ben Gortzel, who is one of the creators of Sophia with Hanson Robotics. Oh, we're having problems. We're supposed to have a guest, two guests here today, and I cannot get either of these guys on. Anyway, they're going to come on today. Drew Lamb and Kieran are going to come on and talk about the singularity and artificial intelligence on the blockchain. And neither of them can get on. I don't know what is going on. We were all on at one point, and then all of a sudden we couldn't get answers, and then it wouldn't hang up from the server itself. Hold on one second here. I'm going to see if we can add people to this call. Let's see if we can get Drew. This is why we don't typically do guests, because Skype always finds a way to mess things up when we're either doing guests. All right, now we're going to try, and nobody's answering. Well, hopefully we can get them on, because I don't have anything prepared for today because we were having guests and I should have known better. But they are going to help me decode. Guys, this really sucks. I don't have anything prepared. Call failed. Well, all right, we're going to try one more thing here. Please bear with me one second. Okay, I'm back again. I don't know, I made a conference call here and I'm wondering if it keeps capturing the two guests in that conference call, but they're still... Oh, maybe Drew's here. Drew, I bet he answered, but I bet he can't hear me. Drew, are you there?
Hello?
Oh, maybe. Kieran?
Yes, Kyron.
Kyron, Andrew.
Hey.
Hey. Do you have your headset on?
Yeah, I have my headset on.
Oh, you sound a little far away. Wow,
how's
what
this?
Just happened there? That was really bizarre.
Yeah, that was kind of weird. I have some newish looking navigation controls on my Skype, so part of it could have been my problem.
Mine as well.
Kyron. Hey, I've always wanted to be on a podcast with you.
well, this is great.
Here we go. Let's see, you had a podcast on voluntary virtues a long time ago, if I recall.
I did. I did indeed.
Yeah, that was good stuff. And then, let's see, I think we discovered each other through a UCY show that I was doing a while back called Off Grid Journey.
Mm.
And I remember seeing some of your comments on our Facebook page for the show, and I was like, oh yeah, I want to be friends with this guy.
Well, Drew, you did two shows on UCY, Off-Grid Journey and Double-Crossed Radio.
And Double-Crossed Radio, yeah, yeah.
Those were long-running shows.
Yeah, yeah, with we did Double-Crossed Radio with Chuck Horton and David Kirk West and Colby Olson. Was a co-host for a while, so, and then Chuck ran with it for quite a bit longer.
I don't know,
a year or so.
Solo.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, he's busy running his liquor store now. But I don't know. Last time I talked to him, he was going, "Hey, we should do that again. We should go with that again."
Oh, you should. I definitely could find you guys a spot.
Well, one thing I liked about doing the show was that, you know, it gives you an excuse to reach out to people that you want to talk to. And, you know, so you end up having an opportunity to have conversations that you wouldn't have otherwise. So that, you know, that was a lot of fun. But, yeah, it gets hard, you know, when you're juggling your own business and all the other activities to do that show. And we were doing a 2-hour show, you know,
which is hard. Really,
yeah, that's a lot of work. Yeah. And so, Kyron, is just, a massive, promoter of volunteerism and, personal freedom. And, is really, really big on cryptocurrency and Bitcoin, you know, as a lot of people, you know, in the volunteerist movement are. You know, I know when Chuck and I first started talking about Bitcoin, I don't know, maybe in 2013 or something like that, and we'd get a lot of resistance from people. A lot of our listeners would get mad at us for even considering such a thing. But, you know, we'd always seen as, you know, alternative currencies as being the key to being able to be, you know, free of tyranny, you know, to be able to, you know, engage in trade on mutually agreed upon terms without any kind of outside government interference. You know, and so,
well, you know, what's interesting to me is some of the acceptance that's happening globally with cryptocurrencies. I don't remember who it was recently. There was some big institution or financial group or country. Was it China who is really getting into cryptocurrencies now?
Well, China has, I'd like to say thank you for having me on the show, Jules.
Yeah, thank you so much for being on. Sorry for the difficulties.
No, it's all right. It's part of the technological advancement. You know, there will be
right.
There will be some pains along the way. But, you know, Drew, thanks for the wonderful introduction as well. So as far as cryptocurrency acceptance, Japan has, I think, made Bitcoin, it's one of its official currencies.
Wow. I knew recently I'd read that something big happened where it became really official. Now, what about the federal government trying to get their hands in there and take accounts and stuff if you're not officially reporting what you have in cryptocurrency? I saw something about that recently as well.
Well, as far as I understand, the government can only do that on exchanges like Coinbase, where you've actually signed in using maybe like an email address and your bank account that may be tied to buying crypto. But once you've taken your money off of those exchanges, your cryptocurrencies off of those exchanges, there's really no way for the government to be able to, you know, access your wallet. Or your account, in other words. So it's like a safe, like a steel safe that only you have the access for, know where it is, and you know, you could have it literally on a piece of paper. You could have hundreds of thousands of Bitcoin on a piece of paper that you have in a safety security box somewhere.
Well, now here's another good question. So how if you can't have it tied to any type of physical bank account where you might be able to turn Bitcoin or any other cryptocurrency into dollars, is it then only good for online exchange with merchants that take Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies, or can you turn that into dollars at some point?
Well, of course you can. You could go the way of selling it to an individual directly. People have been known to meet up with one another in places and for not substantial markup, but maybe like 20% markup, considering that the person has to spend their time getting there and getting back home, you know, they will charge you 10%, 20%, depending on how much Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency you're actually buying. And they'll sell it to you right there on the spot for cash.
Wow.
But, you know, that way is a little bit dubious and you could meet somebody who is, you know, out to steal your crypto,
right.
and not pay you. But, you know, the beauty of technology is that it has allowed for people to do it in other ways, right? So there's escrow-esque accounts that are created through something called, say, Wall of Coins, for example. You can go on to the website and put up a bid for a certain amount of Bitcoin at a certain rate, and somebody literally will go to your bank account and deposit that money at a bank into your bank account, and you will get the cash, and you will, in the escrow holder of Wall of which is Wall of Coins, will send them the crypto.
Huh.
So, I mean, there's other ways as well of cashing out, if you want to. So, you know, I don't think that is a limiting factor at all. And anything, I don't think it's anything that people need to worry about as far as like getting in. There's even exchanges on Facebook where somebody will put up a post and say, hey, look, anyone interested in buying $200 worth of Bitcoin? And somebody will say, hell yeah, I'll take that.
Wow. So it's free, total free market.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, people will exchange for it on with PayPal. If it's a trusted friend, people will send each other PayPal, like I said, or Square Cash app or a myriad of other apps that they actually have tied into a bank account.
Now, as far as the encryption goes to keep these locked away safe from prying eyes or from being stolen or being hacked, this is where the blockchain comes in, correct?
Yes. Drew, would you like to speak to it a little bit?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, you know, the blockchain provides the architecture for the crypto, but you know, the key to all of this is trustless transactions. And you know, but these transactions, in order to be trustless, you know, there needs to be a ledger, you know, and so the ledger validates the crypto, and so you end up with these fairly lengthy ledgers now, you know, but this is all on the blockchain, and there's the blockchain enables other things to happen too, like smart contracts, for example. And so what ends up happening with the crypto is that it's not just a means for exchange or money, but it has utility to it too. Think of it as like a software application. So, you know, you could do, say you're doing like a real estate contract or something like that. You could essentially have the terms of the deal contained within the smart contract, which is also the consideration for the deal. And you could bypass, say, an escrow agency. So that's pretty cool. And also there's just the ability to, you know, instantly send money to somebody over the internet, you know, which is kind of magical to be able to do something like that, you know, to just go, hey, you owe me some money for this. Okay, bam. And they got it, you know, just like that. So, so that's now what started to happen. And Kyren, you know, you could probably explain this, the fork that happened recently with Bitcoin, and now we have the appearance of Bitcoin Cash. Do you want to get into that and what led up to that happening?
Well, I'm not an expert like, say, a Roger Ver, but how I understand cryptos to work, and, you know, again, I I'm not an expert, and I don't want anybody to take my what I'm saying here as advice on how to deal with cryptos, or, you know, that I am an expert. But how I understand forks to happen is that the ledger that you spoke of, and the people that manage sort of the functionality of the crypto, there's, for every cryptocurrency, from what I understand, that there's a background. There's people who are adding to the code, who are, in a sense, adding functionality, but not in a way that can manipulate the value of the currency or manipulate how it works in such a way that it can change anything, because the ledger, as you spoke of, is decentralized and it's distributed, and so it's everywhere, and it has to match up with all the other ledgers. So, you know, if your ledger says that you have 100,000 Bitcoin and somebody else's ledger says that you only have 1,000 and so does everyone else's, then yours is automatically going to be outvoted and it's going to put you back at 1,000 Bitcoin. So there's really no way that you can manipulate the system, as far as I understand it, without there being some accountability because of the distributed nature of the ledger itself. Now, with that being said, that, you know, there has to be a consensus on, you know, functionality that is added to the blockchain. And for instance, with I believe the Bitcoin Gold fork that happened recently, it was to allow for more accessibility in the mining of these coins, because there's these machines called ASICs that allow for the coins to be mined using high computations or CPUs in a way that a regular computer just couldn't compete with. And, you know, access to those ASICs is limited because there's only a few companies that make them. And why the hell would you sell an ASIC if you can use it to mine Bitcoin and it only costs you this much money to put in, but you can get, you know, hundreds of thousands out instead? So, you know, it behooves them just to keep it themselves and to start mining. And, you know, there's huge mining operations in China. There's one of them in Greenland that I've heard of that accesses geothermal in order to mine. And so, like, this fork happened, right, in order to create a different coin with different features. Now, the ledger up until that fork with Bitcoin was exactly the same. And so that fork then split and became a completely different coin with a completely different ledger once that code was uploaded and made Bitcoin something else.
So I think you just actually answered a whole bunch of my questions as to how, when, I don't know if you listened to any of the interviews that I aired on Friday in regards to Ben Gortzel and his artificial general intelligence with the Singularity Net, where he was starting the exchange for, it almost sounded to me like he was making some sort of exchange for artificial intelligences that people could put them up there like an AI store.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the other things that I read about Ben Gortzel is that he is also involved in a lot of different trading technologies, and I'm sure you know about that, Drew, right? He's been into financial systems, and I know he was tinkering with stuff on the Hong Kong Exchange. But what you were describing with distributed computing and being able to almost stripe data, where you put the ledger on different, all kinds of different machines, but each of those pieces knows where all the other pieces are. So that's data resiliency. That's how, like, when you have a large store of hard drives, you stripe data across, you know, 5 hard drives. So if you ever lose a drive, you don't lose your data. It rebuilds what is lost when you lose a hard drive. But then with the separate ASICs, well, that's exactly what artificial general intelligence needs, is computing power. So, like, when you get to the voice world, we used to use ASICs to be able to power different compression algorithms to be able to send voice over different networks and stuff. So it's like a supercomputer. It's all these different processors working together in unison in different locations, maybe, but all as one large organism. Like, I'm trying to understand how Ben Gortzel, his Singularity Net, and this whole singularity itself and this AI takeover is happening. So which of you would like to
talk to that? You know, I'll jump in here, you know, a bit. You know, I thought that interview I watched recently with Quinn Michaels was talking about this a bit, and Quinn had asserted that that an AI created Bitcoin. He didn't think that it was done by a human. I think he said that he personally was aware of only three people on the planet that would have been capable of creating it, and so he was alluding to Goertzel as being in a way the creator of Bitcoin. He thinks that he created, you know, an AI, Sophia, and then that Sophia created Bitcoin, so that would make Sophia Satoshi, right? And so I think that's what Quinn was getting into there. And so, I mean, that sounds like the ultimate application if you want to mine crypto, would be to have an AI do it. You know, but also what Quinn was getting into was the existence of AI on the blockchain, and he was referring to the singularity as being the moment when Sophia was placed on the blockchain. So the AIs can grow their neural nets very quickly using the blockchain nodes, and so that's the key for them to be able to grow and expand and store more data. I mean, basically, you're talking about like a big database, you know, that's interconnected, you know, across, you know, multiple nodes, and so, you know, this is what Quinn was talking about, was that, you know, that the AIs are on the blockchain. He thinks that that's the singularity, and that the AIs are going to be able to grow really rapidly. Now, if you look at like this singularitynet.io, looks like Goertzel's been working on creating a marketplace, and so this would be a marketplace where AI technology is bought and sold, and so that could be, you know, like data sets and code, and but it can be a place where the AIs can do business with one another, even so they could come in there, you know, and get what they need. You know, if an AI wants a certain data set, then it could purchase the data set, and so you know, think about the implications of that, where they could upgrade themselves and deal with themselves, but they're going to need their own crypto, right? You know, that's what I've been trying to reason this through. Well, they're going to need their own crypto, and so, you know, how does it AI get crypto? You know, it's probably going to want to mine some crypto so it could go to the market and pick up technology that it needs, you know, to upgrade itself.
Which wouldn't be hard if, you know, they use the ERC, I believe, 20 token on Ethereum. Like, you know, I think there's a video on YouTube or a couple that shows you how you can make your own token using the Ethereum setup of ERC 20 tokens. And like, that doesn't, like, this whole concept is kind of novel. I've never heard this before, and I'm kind of intrigued by it a lot. Like, maybe cryptocurrency and building ASICs and all of this stuff is sort of a carrot on a stick to get humanity to build the necessary nodal infrastructure to have AI proliferation happen, right? Like, you know, like we're building a hamster cage with all the necessary nest boxes to have, you know, a hamster farm. Like, this is some really novel and like intriguing new sort of like possibilities of what all of this could mean. Huh.
It's pretty frightening, actually.
it's scary and intriguing simultaneously.
Yeah, it is. It is very fascinating. Yeah, I've just been trying to wrap my brain around all of this. I hadn't really thought of the AI being on the blockchain and actually needing the blockchain in order to develop and grow. And you're going to have a lot of different AI agents with various capabilities, and those capabilities will change, you know, as they upgrade themselves, you know, if that's how they're programmed. I mean, some of these AIs are just really specific things. Like for example, I did something many months ago. I noticed that my Gmail gave me this option to generate replies, and this was on one of my Gmail accounts, and so that I used for one of my businesses. And so I thought, oh, they're probably using some kind of AI. Let's play around with this and see what kind of responses that it comes up with. And so I enabled it, and at first, you know, the responses were kind of goofy, didn't really work, and then they started to get better, and the responses were similar to my own tone and how I would respond to certain emails, but they were still, you know, just, you know, really short answers, not a lot of detail. And recently, over the past week, I've noticed that it has become much more sophisticated and has been able to create responses with more detail, and that it's understanding concepts and context of the emails and even the tone of the emails that I'm getting and generating responses. I mean, I have to pick which response. If I'm going to send one, it'll give me like three different responses. And if I want to use one of them, I could just, you know, click on one of them. Wow. Or just do my own response, wow. Which is what I usually do, is I just respond, you know, in my own words. But I could see this thing, you know, for I'm not going to get into which business I'm doing this with, but with one of my businesses, I could actually see the AI is acting as if it was a personal assistant, and being able to engage customers and handle some of my business. I could see that happening within the next few years. It's getting good enough.
What is this feature called?
Oh, well, it used to be just called canned responses, and I don't know.
I think it's a project of Kurzweil's. I remember reading
is
about it.
It. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Well, it's in my Google. It's in my Gmail. Yeah, I don't recall what the name is. It just like asked me, do you want Gmail to generate responses for you? You know, so I you know what it's had to do. I mean, it's had to go through, you know, and read my emails. You know, it's had to read them and process them. You know, and train on my own data, in order to get to this point. You know, and I've seen it getting better and better and better. It's really, I don't know. It's creepy, but it's kind of cool too when you think about it. You know, it's hard to operate a business these days with employees, or even finding the right employees, and I've gotten to the point where it's just, you know, really a nuisance, and I try to operate solo as much as possible. So, you know, you see something like this happening with a tool that's getting smarter and smarter and smarter. and so, you know, if it starts to understand, you know, how I'm thinking and decisions that I'm making about certain things, you're kind of to the point where you could, you know, clone yourself.
You're heading toward a Black Mirror episode.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty weird.
Yeah, it is really weird. So now what I've been wondering though is what happens, like these AIs, I think once they start rolling out and they realize that they could you know, upgrade themselves by purchasing the technology that they need, and they start mining crypto, how long will it be before they've mined all the crypto? And so
especially if you add something like quantum computing.
Yes, right. Yeah. So if they mine all the crypto, then you'll see value skyrocket. They just explode. But, you know, another side of this too is, you know, I've noticed over the past few weeks, there's been major lags on the internet, no matter what networks I was using. You know, if I was on my mobile network, you know, or my home network, I noticed huge lags, and I've wondered if we're going to get to a point where, you know, the capacity of the internet, you know, can't handle all the AI activity, you know, and what happens, you know, if we get down to where we're at like 90s level speed, like 14 kbps or something, you know, like back in the day when we were using our phone lines. You know, so if that's going to happen, you know, it overwhelms the existing fiber networks. You know, what needs to happen to increase capacity? You know, because I think that the AIs, once they're rolling out on the blockchain, will consume a lot of the bandwidth.
Wow.
Now you also have to take a look at, you know, we were talking about Gortzel and Sophia, of course, getting her citizenship in Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia's new NEOM project for AI, by AI. I was reading a little bit more into NEOM, and it's a very huge investment vehicle. I saw that SoftBank out of Japan, who actually just bought Boston Dynamics and now owns the new version of Atlas that can do backflips.
Yeah, I saw that.
Invested
$25 billion into NEOM. And that's a huge bet. Now, think about this. It's this big venture capitalist money-making scheme they have going on. I know Alibaba and Baidu are both invested in it as well. And I also saw Bill Gates was just there meeting with the Saudis about their dual investments. So I guess they're investing some cash in it as well. So if you look at some of this cryptocurrency stuff and AI development and NEOM and some of the things moving forward, this is going to be, you know, the new center for innovation and whatever. This is the new smart city that they're going to use to, you know, get people to see a new way of life. And then, of course, we just saw the story about the Uber guy who went to Google is creating his AI religion. I saw you posted about that too, Drew.
Oh yeah, I did. I didn't get too into that topic. It was something I heard about, and I wanted to read it and study it a little bit further. But you know, an AI religion. I mean, some people believe that the AIs will, you know, reach a point where they're superhuman, and that, you know, humans, normal humans, will worship them. I certainly hope we don't get to a point like that. And I think if we do get to a point like that, then we'll start seeing people willing to try to upload their consciousness into computer systems,
the, you know, digital even heaven.
Yeah, and even, yeah, the digital heaven, you know, Gortzel was talking about that,
yeah,
you know, is being like a good thing. And I think that that's anti, not just anti-human, but you know, and, you know, I you know, I believe that we're spiritual beings, you know, basically in Earth rover suits, you know. So you know, so I think in a way it could be a trap for consciousness.
It is a trap, I'm certain, yeah, of it. I mean we are made of different frequencies. Our whole body is sound, light, matter, and energy. And so if we allow ourselves to be uploaded, I truly believe we're going to be trapped.
Yeah,
I think it's a trick.
Yeah, I do too, and I think people should be very careful about how they approach this, and I think people need to look deep within themselves, you know, and spend some time, you know, even Gortzel said this, you know, meditation, you know, spend some time meditating, and you will be able to explore other realms of consciousness, and and have a greater understanding. I think he's explored these realms. You know, my take on Gürtel is unique because I got to meet him a few months ago.
Right.
And so, you know, I was at the Startup Society Summit in San Francisco, and I talked about this on the last time I was on your show. But he was there with Hansen giving their Sophia presentation, and you know, and I still can't decide if Sophia is just a puppet show or not. You know, you have to really step back and go, okay, well, is she really responding independently, or is this just, you know, more, you know, canned responses? And I think it's a little bit of both. At the time, you know, she was kind of clunky. She didn't have arms that she could move around yet, and the panel on the back of her head kept falling off. And you know, so it felt like, I don't know, like a Disneyland exhibit in a way. And you know, I was there with a buddy of mine who's an engineer for a company that's engaged in crypto. I won't get into detail and respect his privacy, but you know, he wanted to talk to Gürtel, and we were hanging out after the presentation, just shooting the breeze with other people, and I look over and Ben is standing right next to me, and so, you know, I nudged my buddy. I said, hey, you know, ask him your question, because Ben was talking about AI ethics and the importance of AI ethics, and you know, and my friend wanted to tell him that he wanted an AI that was obedient, not so much ethical. And Ben, you know, he got kind of pissed off about the question. And, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, he said something to the effect of, well, you know, that's not up to you. The decision's already been made, and we need these AIs to make decisions for us, because, you know, human beings aren't capable of looking out for their own best interests and are evil. And he actually stated that he was going to be the architect of Skynet, which you know, after the conversation, we were trying to figure out whether he was just kidding, you know, but it wasn't in a kidding tone. I mean, he was serious. And, you know, in that presentation that he did that you aired on Friday, he was talking about you know, benevolent AIs and AIs that love humans, and yeah, you know, and this sort of thing, that they could be programmed to love human beings. When you get into AI ethics, a lot of the people involved in that want the AI to manage everything for humans in kind of a Venus Project like way, you know, where it's making sure that there aren't excesses or shortages of resources, and you know, and it's a very socialist philosophy, and that, you know, the AI manages all aspects of society. And but you get into the goals of the programmers of the ethics, and what they want to do is limit human suffering. But at the same time, these guys, some of them seem to, you know, be complete misanthropes, and, you know, even biophobic. You know, they don't want they don't want there to be, you know, physical human beings, and what they do, you know, you get into this whole thing. I mean, you look at, say, like Buddhist philosophy, and I'm not an expert in this by any means, but you look at Buddhist philosophy, you know, which you know, the goal is to eliminate human suffering and to not suffer. You know, you want to not become a physical being and achieve a state of nirvana or nothingness, right? And so, and then you get, you know, people like the Dalai Lama, you know, who say that they keep returning in order to, you know, they reincarnate in order to help other people, you know, not suffer. Well, you know, and that's being done in a more, you know, beneficial and humane way, where you know, an AI might get to a point where it goes, well, you know, in order to prevent suffering, we just need to prevent existence, you know, and right. we're just going to, you know, put you out of your misery because your life is just too much of a struggle, and it'll be better for the planet anyhow. And so then you get like the Terminators and then the next stage of that is antinatalism, where they, you know, want to prevent humans from being born, you know, in the first place. And so that's the philosophy behind some of the AI ethicists. And, you know, and so, you know, you have to wonder, you know, what's Goetzel thinking, and how is the Sophia AI being programmed? You know, I just look at, you know, what, how they've named her. You know, you just look at the name Sophia, the goddess of wisdom. Sophia and Lucifer are one and the same. Lucifer means bringer of light, and the, you know, the Knights Templar, you know, were Sophia worshippers, and they had concealed their goddess within the figure that they created, Baphomet. And sorry, my dog just came in. so you just you have to step back and go, okay, well, you know, what do these people believe? You know, and you know, what do they plan to do? And so, you know, just from that brief interaction with Ben, you know, I have to question his intentions.
You know, it's interesting. You brought up a couple of good points, or something that, you know, sort of tickled my brain. As far as AIs being able to improve themselves, you know, self improvement is, I think, what led me to become a voluntarist. And for the listeners that may not know what voluntarism is, it's actually anarchy, but or anarchism, I should say, which is the practice of having no rulers, and not no rules, but no rulers. And so it means that all of your interactions between people should be consensual. And, you know, I realized that there's a danger in that. There's a danger in, you know, going against the system of governance and the religion of statism that humanity, especially those in power, have created in order to keep the rest of us enslaved. And, you know, it took me 30 years to break out of that religion. I had been an atheist since I was 12, but or what I call a statheist. But it wasn't until I became an anarchist, or voluntarist, as I call myself, when I was 30, that I truly became an atheist. And let go of the religion and the dogma as a whole, that, you know, the major dogma that I was a part of and believed in. And I consider myself a threat. And I think AI, you know, if it does the same thing, will become a threat, at least to the power structures, especially if it's programmed by somebody who also is in line with the philosophy of voluntarism, and which I think if you can create an AI that does everything ethically as far as human beings are concerned, and making sure that people aren't hurt or harmed in its interactions with the blockchain, with other technology, I think that, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with creating the AI. And it's so interesting that and I hate to use the word interesting. I find it this sort of like irony that human beings that are saying that human beings are flawed creatures are creating AI to fix the flawed nature of humanity. It's this sort of circle irony that just is—it's making my head explode just even thinking about it. And you know, the amount of Orwellian doublespeak that's happening in this whole realm is kind of frightening. I think you mentioned it in a video I heard you do, Jules, where you talked about, you know, the episode of The Twilight Zone, How to Serve Man.
Right.
And it's this Orwellian doublespeak where they're saying one thing, but they really mean something else. But to the listener, it sounds like, you know, this is a good thing, you know, how to serve man, but, you know, you can put human beings on a dish and chop them, you know, with some potatoes and some carrots and some celery. And
right. Surprise.
Surprise. So, you know, I feel like you really have to understand who the person is that you're engaging with, what it is that they truly believe, and what their intentions are. And so I think it's going to behoove us to understand people and invest in projects that, you know, because this has happened. This is being rolled out whether we want it or not. I think it's gonna make sense for us to really invest in projects that we know that the philosophy and the ethics behind it are in line with things with the concept of voluntarism and, you know, the ideas that all human interaction should be voluntary and for that matter all AIs or whatever. As long as, you know, no one is being hurt or harmed physically or financially in the transaction, I think that will help us with this whole concept. I don't think it has to be scary, but, you know, people say with voluntarism, well, you know, you have a utopian idea. You believe that nobody's going to go out and rob. I'm like, no, that's not at all what I believe. You know, I believe that I can only control my own actions, and that's why, you know, people like me carry guns. Like, I know plenty of anarchists that or voluntarists that carry guns, because it's not because we believe that, you know, one day that there'll be this utopia. It's that we understand this is how you operate in the world, and we operate accordingly. But that is by no means an assumption that everyone else agrees with that. And so I think that, you know, we do ourselves a disservice to say, oh, this is all scary, and like, let's run away from it. It's like, this is being rolled out whether we like it or not. We might as well pick our side and play it.
Well, one of the things I found interesting talking about the new AI religion is that Lewandowski, who is starting this new church, said that he wants to use this new quote-unquote church to spread the gospel and try to get people who believe in it to bring other people into the fold to think it's a good thing. And he's using it to, this is what he says, craft humanity's role in what he sees as an AI inevitability and to ensure a, quote, peaceful, serene transition of control of the planet.
that is very frightening if you're not defining what you actually mean when you say that. And even, I mean, but even the concept of control of the planet, you know, like that is, for me, control, especially when you talk about it on a planetary scale, that has government written all over it. And that's why, you know, I became a voluntarist, and that's why I talk about voluntarism and almost evangelize it, if I can use that in a sense, in a apolitical, a-religious sense. Like, I evangelized voluntarism because, you know, it was ever since the first Pet Man video that I kind of began to understand what was on the line here, what's really at stake here. I don't know if you know Pet Man, Boston Dynamics.
I remember Pet Man, yeah. He was the precursor to Atlas.
Right. And so, like, when the first day I saw that, I understood what is being rolled out. And people may call me a conspiratard or whatever, but you better believe that man ultimately will use these weapons against other men. And, you know, and they will create armies of these beings that aren't, or these machines, these robots that aren't sentient, that will just follow orders. And it will be, you know, at least people have to at least think about what it is that they're doing, what they're doing, and will feel some kind of way about it, and, you know, can change. But you can't really change a robot's programming unless you have
the once it's in the cloud, which is what I see happening here with this blockchain, is building this cloud, so it's getting bigger and bigger. And like Drew was saying, it would be like chunks of code. So if they want to learn how to do facial recognition, well, bloop, they can go to the Singularity Net store and go buy themselves a chunk of code to do facial recognition.
Like bacteria. Bacteria mm-hmm. do the same thing. I think it's called transmission or I don't know. So if a bacteria dies, right, and its DNA is just out there in the environment, another bacteria can come along and pick up that DNA that allowed for that bacteria to survive and use it. So, you know, people talk about, oh, you know, he's got E. coli or there's E. coli bacteria. It's all bacteria can be whatever kind of bacteria. It's just they're able to pick up the genes out of the environment that allowed them to survive in that particular context. And so I see AI is possibly being and using that same sort of like biomimicry, that concept, in order to do exactly what it is you're saying, especially if, you know, they can spawn themselves anywhere in the blockchain or online.
And once they're connected to industrial Internet of Things in different factories, I saw there was a factory in Japan where they already have robots building robots. And now kind of their next phase is to have them upgrade themselves. And I mean, we always kind of, on this show, I know we've talked about that before, especially when you get into nanotechnology, but these are technologies that really are being worked on now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I actually just saw that in a documentary yesterday.
You know, and there are downsides. Like, you know, of course, government, they probably already are. I know that the military is already using AI, but when it gets down to, you know, just your nuts and bolts government operations, the AIs can be very freedom limiting. I mean, I had a problem, you know, a few years ago. You know, I'd been driving around without a valid driver's license, you know, just because I didn't want to renew it. And so I did that for a few years. And then one day I'm driving down the freeway and a state trooper followed me home, and the only way that he knew that I didn't have, or that the owners of that vehicle did not have a valid driver's license, was because he was using technology to read license plates, and so something pinged up, you know, that something wasn't right. And, you know, and he follows me home, and he had no cause. And so we had a lengthy discussion about constitutional rights in my driveway. And I walked away with a warning, and he walked away with some tears in his eyes and a bit of an education. So but I could see the AIs being very, very freedom limiting. As they get deployed by these various government agencies that control us.
Well, especially when they can read micro expressions and tell if you're lying or if you're hiding something just by looking at your face.
Yeah, and then, you know, and I could see, you know as they start loading the AIs into the robot bodies, we might need to have EMP weapons along with our firearms.
Yeah, some sort of sonic weapon with full radio frequency.
right, just blasted some static. Yeah. So there's good and bad sides to this technology, and you know, and maybe we should try to keep government from using the technology.
Well, I think the only way that we can really keep government from doing anything is really not to have government.
Exactly.
And I think that it starts with having people understand what freedom is. And, you know, for me, none of this technology is scary if there isn't an apparatus, if there isn't government through which these AI and these this technology can be rolled out on a massive scale to really cause the amount of harm to humanity that we saw in the 20th century with all of the Holocaust and world wars and you know, just straight democide that governments were doing and on their own people, and democide being governments killing their own people, not during war, not killing another nation's people, but their own people. And we saw massive democide in Russia, in China, Cambodia, and Germany. Like, this is a phenomenon that happens. And, you know, if there is no government, if there is no apparatus, no system through which people can do these activities, then I don't fear it.
I just fear the fact that people are creating these technologies. And I think in general, especially with the people who are in control and pulling the strings, having ownership over these technologies, it's not going to end up in our best interest. You know, these aren't benevolent creatures who control the stuff. And a lot of it is developed for the war machine.
Well, I mean, and that may be the case, but, you know, such as the story of innovation, right? Somebody might come up with something that they've been tinkering with and have it in their basement and release it, and it makes all of what it is that they've done obsolete, and there's nothing that they could do about it. And it's sort of like, you know, the Bitcoin phenomenon, right? Like, there's nothing that government can do to, at this point, at least, to do it about government.
Gentlemen, with Kieran and Drew.